Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Blue Collar, Blue Scrubs, The Making of a Surgeon by Michael J. Collins, M.D., narrated by John Pruden. Introduction. Have you ever noticed that 2 plus 2 doesn't always equal 4? It didn't for me, and I guess that's what this story is all about. I'm a surgeon now. I spend my days in quiet, sterile operating rooms, replacing knees and repairing rotator cuffs. A hard day in the hole would kill me. But back then, I was a laborer. I spent my days breaking concrete and throwing rocks, and I liked it. The time would come when all that digging and lifting and breaking and throwing would be too much. But not then. Then it was fun. It was fun to push ourselves beyond all reasonable limits. It was fun to have some strutting, bellowing foreman threaten to fire our asses if we didn't break out some insanely long section of concrete in the next 12 hours. We'd grumble and curse. We'd complain that this was typical Scalisi slave-driving bullshit. We'd say that nobody could break out that much concrete in one day. What did they think we were, a bunch of fucking mules? But somewhere deep inside, we liked it. We liked being given unreasonable, outrageous tasks. Nothing was too much for us, and when they told us to break out 2,000 feet of concrete in one day, we understood they were paying us a compliment. Nobody could break out that much concrete in one day, but we could. We'd kick the water cooler, and we'd say Fred could kiss our asses, but all the while we'd be pulling on our gloves, rolling our shoulders, and eyeing that long stretch of concrete. Bring it on, we'd think. Bring it on. 12 hours later, our forearms would be scratched and bleeding from being ground all day against the broken slabs of concrete. Our t-shirts would be sopping wet and tattered. Our ears would be ringing from 12 hours stooped down next to the jackhammer. We would be stretched out in the grass, boots off, drinking beer, looking back on the seemingly endless expanse of concrete we had just broken out, and thinking we had the world by the balls. That's what I miss about those days. It's something my friends and fellow doctors can never understand. All they see is the drudgery, the mindless slaving labor, the subjugation of the spirit. But they don't realize how liberating it can be. To train your body, to make it so strong that labor enthralls it and quickens your life impulses so that all that work becomes as nothing, becomes the fuel that fires your life, that makes it worth getting up in the morning to laugh and drink and feel your muscles. Sure, somewhere inside you know it's temporary. You know you are dipping into your reservoir of youth and throwing away a little more of it each day. But that reservoir seems so vast, so inexhaustible. You know there will be a day of reckoning, but until that day comes... I suppose if you asked me what I was doing, I wouldn't have had an answer. I lacked what my college professors would have called critical awareness. I was about as introspective as a rebar. I worked breakout because I was good at it, because it paid well, but most importantly, because it told me things I wanted to hear. It told me I was young. It told me I was strong. It told me I was alive. But toward the end, it started telling me other things, too. Things I was not ready to hear. Jesse and JT and Angelo, guys who had been around for a while, they could hear it all too plainly. It fairly shouted to them. But as yet, it only whispered to me. It whispered that, yes, I was young, but youth is fleeting. Yes, I was strong, but strength is illusory. Yes, I was alive, but louder every day it whispered that I was going to die. And on that hot summer day when I finally heard that whisper, it hit me like a 20-pound sledgehammer. And at that moment, I knew that if I ever wanted to accomplish anything important in life, I'd better get going. Chapter 1. In the final stirrings of the night, the door opens and I'm back in the hole throwing rocks. I've filled another truck with them, but Angelo isn't taking them to the dump. Instead, they're going somewhere else, I roll over and flail again at the alarm clock. It's 5 a.m. I'm late, and I know it. I groan, push myself up, and run a hand across my face. I throw off the blanket, struggle to my feet, yank on my jeans, and throw a t-shirt over my shoulder. I sleep on the floor in the attic of my parents' house, and as I pad downstairs in my bare feet, the house is quiet. My parents and 7 younger brothers won't be up for another hour or two. As I pass Tim's room, I bump open the door with my hip and flip on the light. Tim is lying on his right side, sheets twisted around him. I call his name and tell him I had fun with Diane last night. Diane is Tim's girlfriend. "I think I finally convinced her she's going out with the wrong brother," I tell him. Tim yawns, pulls the sheet over his head, and tells me to keep dreaming. "What girl in her right mind would go out with you?" he asks. I scratch my head, realize Tim is probably right, and turn off the light. Down in the kitchen, Shannon is curled up in the corner. She gets slowly to her feet, stretches, and dutifully shuffles over. I bend down, scratch her behind the ears, and tell her she is beautiful. Shannon yawns and goes back to the corner. I wolf down a couple bananas and pour a glass of orange juice. As I am drinking the juice, I grab 8 slices of bread, lather 4 with peanut butter, 4 with jelly, then fold them into sandwiches and toss them in a paper bag. In the corner of the icebox, I find a boiled potato, 2 apples, and a plastic bowl of macaroni and cheese. I throw them in the bag, too. I fill my old quart glass Coke bottle with water, grab my boots from the back door, and trot out to the car. I toss my boots and lunch on the seat next to my hard hat, plop down into the driver's seat, and start the ignition. Blue-gray smoke belches from the exhaust as the old Pontiac rumbles into life. It is 5:50 when I jam on the brakes outside the 10-foot-high chain-linked fence that surrounds the Vittorio Scalisi Construction Company. The morning sun is streaming down Grand Avenue. Bakery trucks and newspaper vans are dragging long shadows behind them as they head east into the city. I grab my hard hat and lunch bag, slam the door of the Pontiac, and sprint through the gates past the large pile of wooden stakes that dominates the center of the yard. Behind the stakes, a 30-foot-high shed with a corrugated iron roof shelters a table saw, more stakes, and 2 enormous piles of black dirt. Fred is standing at the door of his office. He looks at his watch and says, "Good afternoon, Senator. Where the hell you been? Your crew left 30 minutes ago." I tell Fred I'm sorry I'm late. "Save the bullshit," he says. "Now take the rat and get your ass out with your crew. You're lucky I didn't send Vito in your place and let you spend a couple of days working here in the yard." Working in the yard is easy, but it's punishment. The yard is for guys who are too old or too incompetent to go out on the jobs. Yard birds, we call them. They pull nails, load trucks, and cut stakes. No one ever worked themselves to death in the yard. As I turn to leave, Fred says, "By the way, you look like shit." So does the rat. The rat is Scalisi's oldest piece of equipment, a battered old stake truck, its original shiny red finish bleached to a tired brown from years of baking under scorching summer suns. Its windshield is cracked and dirty. Its body is splattered with rock-hard gobs of mud and concrete. Its doors are creased and dented from collisions with backhoes, compressors, and scoops. The 2 white rod racks sticking up on either side of the hood list drunkenly inward. The running board on the driver's side is loose and hangs at a 45-degree angle. Inside, a dirty piece of burlap and an old Chicago Yellow Pages phone book cover the worn foam rubber and springs where the driver's seat used to be. The floor is littered with cigarette butts, beer cans, hamburger wrappers, expansion joints, form tools, pick heads, oil cans, and a ragged copy of the Sun-Times. 33 die in French Quarter fire. The dashboard is littered with nails, old lunch bags, and toll tickets. In the center of the steering wheel, someone has scratched his name, Steve. Under it, someone else has written, "Blows." I climb into the rat, adjust the phone book, fire up the engine, and highball it out of the yard. From the doorway, Fred shouts at me to slow down. "What do you think this is, the Indy 500? Even though it's late, I stop the truck outside Mary's Grill at Cumberland and Grand. It's not even 6 yet, so there aren't many cars on the road. I click on the hazard lights, leave the rat in the right-hand lane, and jump out of the truck. Bill is sitting on the steps outside the grill. He is bent forward, knees drawn up, hands and arms clenched in front of his chest. At least he's not passed out in the bushes again. I touch him on the shoulder. "Hey, Bill, you okay?" Bill lifts his head, cocks it, and looks at me out of his right eye. His left eye is swollen shut. "Hello, Tommy," he says. "I've told Bill a million times my name is Mike, but he still thinks I am his nephew Tommy. What happened to your eye, Bill?" Bill frowns, feels his eye for several seconds, then shakes his head. "Dunno," he says. "Dunno." He rubs his scraggly beard. "Hate to ask, Tommy, but could you..." "Sure, Bill," I say. I reach into my pocket and hand him a five. "Now, come in and get some breakfast." "Thanks. Thanks a lot, Tommy." Inside, four other Scalise guys are at the counter, hunched over coffee and eggs. "The hell you looking at?" Vito asks as I enter. "Am I the first Italian movie star you ever seen?" Brother-in-law, sitting next to him, grunts. "Huh. They don't show no faces in the kinds of movies you be in," he says. I ignore them both and tell Mary she looks beautiful this morning. Mary wipes the hair back from her forehead, rolls her eyes, and says she doesn't know why in the name of God she ever went into this business. "Sweet-talking bullshit," she says. "That's all I ever hear in this place. Sweet-talking bullshit from guys who tell me I'm beautiful, and can they pay me later?" She squirts a little grease on the griddle. "You gonna order something or what?" "Bacon and egg sandwich and a carton of milk." Vito snickers. "Put it in a bottle with the nipple on it," he tells Mary. Mary tells him to shut up. She says if Vito drank more milk, maybe he wouldn't look like such a broken-down lowlife. 3 minutes later, she rips off a piece of grease paper, wraps my sandwich in it, and slides it across to me. $2.25, she says. I give her $3 and tell her to keep the change. "Better hurry, boys," I say to the other Scalise guys as I'm leaving. "You don't want to be late. Your Uncle Fred misses his little yard birds." Brother-in-law pounds his fist on the counter. "Uncle Fred can kiss my black ass," he shouts as I hustle out the door. Outside, Bill is still slumped against the wall. I look at my watch, hesitate, then help Bill to his feet and walk him inside. He's too wobbly for a chair at the counter this morning, so I sit him in one of the booths. I take the $5 bill from his right hand, raise it up, and show it to Mary. "Could you bring Bill some bacon and eggs and maybe a cup of coffee?" I ask her. Mary never says no when it comes to Bill. She waves me out the door. "Get out of here. You leave Bill to me." I shake Bill's shoulder. "Mary's going to bring you some breakfast, Bill," I tell him. "Thanks, Tommy," he mumbles. I tear out the door, hop into the truck, honk the horn, slam the rat into first, and swing her left toward Eisenhower. It's almost 6:30 when I pull up at the job site. We don't officially start work until 7, but there is a tradition at Scalise called working for the church. This means that although we don't get paid till 7, we start working at 6:30 or 6, or sometimes 5:30. The other members of my crew are gathered around the compressor laughing and drinking coffee from white styrofoam cups. Johnny Battaglia, our foreman, is sitting on the tailgate of his pickup reading the trib. I pull up next to him. He looks up from his paper and says it's nice of me to stop by. Then he tells me, "Park that piece of shit, rat, and go help JT with the hoses." JT is a 35-year-old black man, father of 6. He runs the gun on Johnny's crew. His forearms are as big as a caveman's club. By the time I get over to him, he already has the hoses laid out. "Mike," he says, "the hell you been, man? Sipping tea with the Yardbirds?" "Nah, I just slept late, that's all." "Old Fred, he don't like that shit." "Yeah, he let me know." As I'm pulling the gloves from my back pocket, Joe Rosselli flings the dregs of his coffee onto the ground, crushes his cup, and throws it in the gutter. Then he slaps my belly with the back of his left hand. "Hey, man, I was starting to get worried," he says. Rosie is a 20-year-old kid who played linebacker at Eastern Illinois until he flunked out last year. He is built like a chunk of granite. Johnny Battaglia stole him from Pappy Chirinchoni's crew back in April and won't give him back because he works so hard. Rosie, JT, and I have been working together on the breakout gang all year. Scalisi is in the concrete construction business. What we construct are mostly curbs and gutters, but before the new ones can be put in, the old ones have to be broken out. That's where the breakout gang comes in. The gun runner breaks the old gutters into jagged 100-pound hunks of concrete. Then the rock thrower bends down, his face inches from the pounding jackhammer, lifts the piece, or rock, and throws it onto the back of a truck. Rock after rock, hour after hour, day after day. Throwing rocks, the toughest job at the toughest construction company in Chicago. When people ask me what I'm doing with my Notre Dame education, and I tell them I throw rocks, they say, "Your parents must be very proud." The sun is knifing between the warehouses and factories, laying long bars of light across Western Avenue. There was rain during the night, and the sidewalks are glistening and fresh. The morning wind is ruffling the burlap on the back of the rat. Far to the north, I can hear the rumble of the L. Johnny Battaglia looks at his watch. It's 6:30. He folds his paper, throws it in the cab, and slaps his hands together. All right," he says. "We ain't got all day. Get that Solaire going and let's get to work." JT swings the air hammer off the back of the truck and fits it with a bit. Rosie and I grab pick heads from under the seat and slide the heads down worn ash shafts. Jesse climbs onto the back of the rat and throws off a couple shovels. Then JT fires up the compressor. He lugs his gun over to the first section, looks at me and Rosie, grins, and squeezes the trigger. Suddenly, the morning silence is shattered by the roar of the compressor, the thunder of the jackhammer, the bellowing of the foreman, and the rumble of the big trucks jockeying into position. "Now bend down and lift those rocks," Johnny shouts. "Asses and elbows, that's all I want to see for the next 12 hours. Asses and elbows." "Asses and elbows," JT bellows as he hammers away at the concrete, chips flying everywhere. "Asses and elbows," Rosie roars as he lifts the first piece, walks it over, and heaves it onto the back of the rat. "Asses and elbows," Angelo shouts as he revs up his truck and backs it next to the compressor. In an hour, the rat is loaded and ready for the dump. Even though I'm the one who drives the rat every day, I'm a laborer, not a driver. Our driver is a 42-year-old guy named Angelo Sansonetti. We need two trucks on the job every day, so Angelo brings one truck, I bring the other. When he was young, Angelo used to throw rocks too. "Until I finally got brains and became a driver," he says. Angelo pulls his truck up behind mine, hops into the rat, and heads for the dump. Rosie and I then begin loading Angelo's truck. The final member of our crew is Jesse Perkins. Jesse is a short, stocky black guy who, according to Angelo, has been with Scalisi since Jesus was a corporal. Jesse is a little more specific. "Shit," he says. "I started with this company the day after old Abe Lincoln got himself shot." Night or day, rain or shine, Jesse wears a pair of black wraparound sunglasses and baggy blue overalls, in which he keeps a half pint of V.O. and 3 or 4 cans of Schlitz. He is missing 3 of his upper teeth and 5 of his lower. Jesse likes to talk, and he's got a few years on him, but Rosie and I like him. We let him do the grading while we throw the rocks. About 9 o'clock, the little kids and the old men start coming out of their houses to watch us. The kids stand on the edge of the sidewalk, eyes wide, hands to their sides, afraid to get too close, but fascinated by the roar of the machines and the grunts of the laborers. The old men sit on their porches, saying nothing, watching us from under straw fedoras as we hurl rock after rock onto the bed of the truck. Sometimes we can almost see the longing in their creased faces. An hour later, the coffee truck pulls up. JT wedges his jackhammer in a crack, and we stop for a break. As we drink our coffee, Angelo starts in again on JT. "JT, you must really want that foreman job," he says. "Look how much you've broken out already. For Christ's sake, you're killing the job. We could have stretched this section into half a day at least. Keep it up, big guy. Next thing you know, they'll be giving you 20 blocks a day to break out." Rosie is sitting on the back of the rat, his hard hat pushed back on his head and his legs swinging free.
"Hey, JT," he says, "when you make foreman, you gonna have any white guys on your crew?"
JT, whose black skin is glistening with sweat, wipes his mouth with the back of his hand and nods.
"Damn right," he says, "but not just white. They're all gonna be Italians. You the only one stupid enough to work like this."
JT looks over and sees me smiling.
"What are you laughing at, shit for brains?" he asks. "You gonna be there too?"
"Mm-hmm,
that's right. Throwing rocks is all you dumb Irish motherfucks is good for."
"And eating potatoes,"
Angelo says. "You ever see people who eat as many potatoes as those damn Irish? For Christ's sake, they inhale the damn things." Johnny Battaglia says he doesn't care who eats what as long as they work. He turns to JT.
"Now get that gun running. I want the rest of this block broken out by noon."
I stuff one more donut in my mouth, then Rosie and I heave ourselves to our feet and slip our gloves back on. JT starts the compressor, swings the air hammer around like a toothpick, and begins slamming away at more concrete. We spend the rest of the morning slowly moving north, JT breaking out the rocks, Rosie and I throwing them on the trucks, Jesse trailing behind us with the scoop shovel, and Angelo shuttling back and forth to the dump. When noon comes, JT leans on his air hammer against the Solaire and shuts it down. Rosie and I climb out of the hole and go back to the rat where we left our lunches. Jesse and Angelo grab their lunch boxes, and the five of us find a spot of shade next to a fence. Angelo picked up a couple six-packs of Old Style on his way back from the dump. We lean against the fence, legs extended, eating sandwiches and drinking beer. We are quiet until a rat sticks his nose out of the sewer. Since we spend so much time breaking out curbs and gutters, we are always running across rats. Jesse throws an empty beer can at it and says he hates the fucking things. He wipes his red bandana across his forehead and says that rat reminds him of a young girl who used to live down the street from him. Rosie looks at me over his can of Old Style and shrugs. It looks like we're in for another one of Jesse's stories.
"She'd be living over there on Holman Avenue, up on the fourth floor," he says. "She gets her welfare check on Friday, then splits, leaving her five-year-old to watch the baby. She come home that night and sees that baby is awful quiet. She pulls back the cover, and five rats jump out at her. Those rats had eaten that baby clean up to the chest."
I groan and look at Jesse in disbelief, but he swears it's true.
"Yeah, babe. The police took the other child away from her and hauled that woman's ass off to jail."
From rats, we started talking about other animals. JT, who was raised on a farm in Arkansas, claims that there are only three animals that are untrainable: the possum, the buzzard, and the bulldog. Jesse says he knows a whorehouse down near 47th and Calumet that has a bulldog.
"Man," he says, "that place is wide open. You can get anything you want in there. Anything. A woman, a dog, a sheep, a mule, even a damn monkey."
He tells us about running out of there one night during a raid with his pants around his ankles, cops chasing him, and a woman in a tiger-striped tube top screaming she hadn't been paid. I've learned a lot of things at Scalise, things they never taught me at Notre Dame. I am 24 years old, 5 feet 11 inches, 190 pounds. At one time I thought I was pretty hot stuff, but I didn't know what tough was until I started working here. Not one man in 100 walking the streets of Chicago would last a day out here throwing rocks. But Scalise has a dozen of them, young, strong, intemperate, spoiling for a fight, ready to accept any challenge. There are guys here who stand 5'6", weigh 140 pounds, and can outwork, outdrink, outswear, and outfight me and 10 guys like me any day of the week. But I make a good buck. I like the work. The guys are decent. All in all, I think I've got a pretty good thing going here.
Chapter 2. 5:30 a.m. A dark, overcast morning. The air is damp and heavy. Low black clouds are scudding in from the west. A soft rain is drifting across Grand Avenue, and a gentle breeze is rippling the puddles in the yard. Because of the rain, Fred has ordered all the burlap trucks to be pulled under the stake shed. He told the crews to wait for a while before they go out to their jobs. 2 dozen laborers and drivers are scattered around the furnace room praying for rain, hoping to be sent home. Rosie is stretched out on the floor, eyes closed, hands behind his head, hard hat pulled low over his eyes. Jesse and JT are sitting next to each other on a stack of bags of Portland cement. Angelo is standing at the door watching the rain. He grunts his greeting as I come in. I grab a 5-gallon bucket, turn it over, and sit down. Then I reach into my lunch bag, take out a chicken leg, and start munching.
"That all you do is eat?" JT asks. "You the eatin'est man I ever saw."
He elbows Jesse.
"Chicken," he says, nodding at me. 5:30 in the morning and the boy is eating chicken.
Jesse pushes up his sunglasses and says,
"Well, lucky he got that. Otherwise, he'd be poking his nose in our lunches, wanting to know where the donuts and cookies at."
I shrug my shoulders and say nothing. We're quiet for a while when Angelo starts telling stories of an old laborer named Mario who used to live above the office. Ange swears he has seen Mario, who died 5 years ago, walking around the yard late at night. Angelo's not the only guy who thinks this place is haunted. Most of us laugh it off, but Jesse doesn't think it's funny.
"Don't fuck with that shit," he says. "Leave that shit alone."
We sit quietly for the next hour until it starts raining harder and a rumble of thunder rolls across the yard. We can hear the drum of rain on the corrugated iron roof above us. Jesse starts imitating the thunder, making a low growling noise deep in his throat until JT tells him to shut the fuck up. Finally, at 7:15, Fred comes down and sends us home. Most of the guys are happy to have the day off, but I'm not. I need the money, and these rainy days are killing me. That's why I started driving a cab. If we get rained out of construction, I've got another job to turn to. Driving a cab doesn't pay as well as throwing rocks, but the money isn't bad, especially when it's raining. I drive over to the Blue Cab Garage on South Boulevard and check in with Bernie. He gives me Blue 34, and I wheel out of the garage, splashing through the rain toward the cab stand on Harlem Avenue. I pick up the mic and let the dispatcher know I'm in service.
"Blue 34, 10-8, I say.
10-4, 34, the dispatcher replies.
Since it's raining, business is good. I take a couple old ladies to the L, bring some businessman with a big yellow bow tie out to O'Hare, and do a few local trips. Around noon, I remember the lunch run with Mr. Beatty.
"Blue 34, I say into the mic. "You got anyone for Mr. Beatty today?"
10-5, 34, the dispatcher says. "You want him?"
"Sure, I'll do it."
Mr. Beatty is an 80-year-old guy who used to own some big manufacturing company. He retired a few years ago and now has nothing to do but sit around his apartment all day, shuffling $100 bills and playing tiddlywinks with Krugerrands. He has a standing order with the Blue Cab Company for a driver to take him to lunch every Wednesday. This is a guy who could probably buy both the restaurant and the cab company and not miss a beat, and yet he has to pay cab drivers to go to lunch with him. Bernie says he has a family, but I guess they're too busy spending the old man's money to hang around with him. A lot of the other drivers don't like Mr. Beatty. The guy has more money than God, but he doesn't tip very well.
"What the hell's he going to do with all that dough? Line his coffin with it?" one of the other drivers asked me.
I feel sorry for the old guy. Yeah, he's loaded, but so what? There are bums living in alleys off Madison Street who have more fun than he does. I park the cab in front of his apartment building and ring the bell. Sophia, his caretaker, always answers right away. She has Mr. Beatty in a chair by the door with his jacket already on. As usual, she glares at me. Sophia is about as friendly as a hungover repo man.
"Now, sir," she says to Mr. Beatty, "here's your driver. It's time for your lunch."
She motions for me to help him up and take his arm.
"Otto's Restaurant," Sophia says to me, like I haven't done this a half dozen times before. "They will have a table waiting for you," she tells me.
She marches us over the threshold and quickly closes the door. Mr. Beatty holds tightly to my left arm as we shuffle toward the cab.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Collins," he says.
Sophia, his maid, probably has a net worth of $6.
She has met me 10 times and has no idea what my name is. Mr. Beatty.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?